Talk given Sunday, 1st December 1974. Whether an individual or a community or a nation is living the worldly life only, or whether individuals are also concerned with the religious life, everyone, sometime or other, is faced with problems. Problems are never absent from our lives. And those of us whose fundamental concern is the living of the religious life and bringing to fruition the religiousness which is deeply hidden in our nature, have to find the meaning of the word problem and the right approach to every problem. There is no right approach to any problem. For the person who is wholly involved in living a worldly life, he will everlastingly have problems and be the progenitor of problems for himself and for his environment. But we have to find out what is the real meaning of this word problem. You know how we all tend to regard a problem as something external which has come upon us and troubles us. Now, is that really the case? Is it only something external in the shape of things, of events, of various forces and influences that arise within the family circle or in our national life or international life? Is it solely something external? Let us take an analogy first from our school days. Supposing we study a subject like geometry. We learn certain theorems in which certain premises are given, and we make certain deductions from those premises in order to prove something. And if the deductions are made correctly, logically, step by step, at the end we state, therefore, so and so, and put QED at the end. Quite easily done, as the schoolboy says. And we say we have learned the theorem. Now, the theorem teaches us some particular principle which has a very wide application. That is what the theorem itself teaches us. And then in our geometry books, we have a whole set of problems given us based upon that theorem. We have to use our knowledge of that theorem and apply that knowledge in order to solve these problems, as we call them. And you know how easy it is in most cases to learn the theorem by memory, write down all the words, get full marks in the exam as far as the theorem goes, and then afterwards we chew the end of our pen or pencil, racking our brains how to solve the particular problem which has been set upon that theorem, on the basis of that theorem. Now, why is this? Why can't we tackle the problem straight away? After a certain amount of shortening of the pencil or pen, as the case may be, with our chewing of it, we may, as we say, hit upon the solution and say, oh, I've got it. And there you are. And you put down very happily at the end, QED, solve the problem. We were able to apply it. Now, why were we not able to apply it in the beginning, and sometimes never at all? What is the reason for that? We thought we knew the theorem inside out. We knew it by memory, we put down all the steps logically, gave the perfect answer. But when the problem came up, we couldn't do it. If we look into the matter deeply, we shall discover that whilst we memorized like a parrot the theorem itself as presented in the textbook on geometry, we never really understood every single step thoroughly. So inwardly, we had not really learned the theorem. We had not understood it. And the difficulty was due fundamentally to the fact that I myself was short of understanding. So the heart of any problem is actually within myself, my shortness of understanding. This is an important point to bear in mind. Life will always present circumstances which are troublesome, which are perhaps unexpected and unforeseen, and disturb us. Our equilibrium is upset. We become anxious. We become confused. And we say, oh, good gracious, now how do I deal with this thing? Life will always do that. That is the outer shell of my problem as it comes to me. Just the outer shell. Inside myself is my state of confusion, my lack of understanding, my incapacity to be quiet, use my senses and intelligence. This is the real problem where life is concerned. It is not so much the external shape. The problem basically is within myself. And especially where the coming to fruition of ourselves as true human beings is concerned, by far the greater part of the problem is within oneself always, without exception. You know how easy it is for us to say, but I did nothing to bring about this situation. Why has it come upon me like this? I have made no mistakes. So it appears to me, to my conscious mind. But is that true? Have you not noticed that a certain peculiar pattern of events keeps repeating itself in a person's life? But not in the life of his neighbor, his brother, his father, or his child. Why? In those people, different patterns repeat themselves. Whence comes this pattern? What is this force or power within my living being which produces repetitive patterns in my own life? You know how they say with regard to some people, whatever he touches turns to gold. He's always making money. Another person, wherever he goes, there's always trouble, although he's a very nice fellow. And so on. These patterns repeat themselves. Why? Is it the fault of the external world only? Or is there something inside myself which allows those patterns always to come up against me? And further, in fact, actually draws those patterns unto myself. You see, life is a very complex and an extraordinary thing. We don't understand the workings of a tenth, maybe a fiftieth, of all the forces at play. That which lies within the depths of my inner consciousness, of which I am consciously aware only to a very small extent, that which lies in the depths of my inner consciousness is the force that draws the patterns, the external shape of things to me. This is something which is not known to the world at large. It is one of the deep teachings. It is practically an esoteric, hidden teaching of the great religions. Even in, for example, the first two verses of the Buddhist Dhammapada, where it is said that mind is the maker of all our tendencies of character. That phrase has been used, but it actually, the actual word used is Dhamma, and it stands for states of mind, mental states, meaning your feelings, your perceptions, and so forth, you see. Mind is the producer of all those. If the mind is impure, then suffering follows you as inevitably as the wheel of the cart follows the ox that pulls the cart. If the mind is pure, then happiness comes to you, just as inevitably. But be careful not to use our worldly definition of happiness there. Now, although the word used is mano, meaning mind, the state of mind, strictly speaking, they should use a word which implies the innermost depths of consciousness. Because mind is rather, the English word mind is a somewhat loose word, covering all aspects of mind. It is your inmost consciousness And this is something which is transcendent to our conscious, ordinary intellectual perception. Consciousness is transcendent to it. You inquire, what is consciousness? You can't answer the question really. You can say certain things which are plausible sounding, but look into it deeply enough and the end result is, I don't know. Even the word mind, it's a loosely used word representing phenomena which take place in the psychophysical organism, which we call mental and emotional processes and states and so forth, and we just loosely use the word, that's my mind. Don't know what mind is. So now, this is the important point to bear, to remember, that it is my innermost state of consciousness which is considerably, almost all of it is hidden from my gaze, which is the force, the power that draws unto me all that happens in my living process during my lifetime. You see, the reason why the doctrine of karma in the East is so deep. We think we have understood it when we talk very facilely and plausibly about, oh yes, you do this and therefore that is the result and so forth. That's all superficial stuff. And a great deal of it is awful nonsense. It just doesn't work out that way if you take the trouble to look deeply into it. But this thing, karma, is a great mystery. Karma, action. Action means power manifesting, doing something, producing something, energy. We don't know this energy. We don't know its workings. They are too tremendous, too subtle for us to know. And we must be very careful to keep free of glib, facile, verbal explanations. So now, right within the depths of consciousness, this great karmic force is at work. Karmic in the sense of action, active. Energy which is in action. And it is this which draws the patterns of events in our lives. From day to day, from decade to decade, and so forth. Now, the teaching about the mind being pure or impure determines the nature of the external form of the events. Whether they are going to be ill or well. I won't use the terms unpleasant or pleasant because they have too limited a scope. But the words ill and well will cover the whole situation. So the external shape of the events is a question of the state of the mind, the kind of mind one brings to bear upon the actual situation. And the kind of mind I bring to bear upon the actual situation is totally involved with my understanding, my intelligence at play, my wide awakeness at its root. No man can be more intelligent than is allowed by the extent of his wide awakeness. This is the point. The extent to which one is wide awake determines what sort of intelligence and how effective that intelligence is when you bring it to bear upon what we call the problem. And if we are intelligent, we will see that the external thing and myself are one whole situation. If I am sensible enough, intelligent enough, to see how I, the person, am involved in my situation, then I will not regard the situation as something separate from me or try to push it away from me, because that means everlasting conflict, not a resolution of the conflict. Is that quite clear? So you see, why it is taught that we are the makers of our own lives. We are responsible for it all. It's no good blaming the other person. Blame the other person and you will have not only the so-called external problem as your enemy, but the other fellow also. Then we'll have two enemies to deal with instead of one. Now it is very hard to see this, you know, because there are forces inside ourselves, our vanities and our egoism, our amour propre, that gets so offended at thinking that I did anything wrong or that I am foolish or I am incapable. It's always, I am a fine fellow, I am a good fellow, I am a sensible, canny fellow, and all that nonsense. This is the thing that comes in the way, this egoism, this vanity, self-vanity. So it's not easy then to see the situation as a whole, in which one acknowledges and fully recognizes the fact that I myself am the very center, the very source of what I call the trouble. Not only as far as the external situation is concerned, but as far as making further mistakes in relation to that situation is concerned. Because how do I approach the problem? Until I see that it and I are one and the same thing, I always approach it as an enemy. How can I bring about a resolution of the situation, which is a harmony, if I approach anything as an enemy, if I'm in conflict with it? It's a discord, not a concord. It's very important to see this. Now, I've said all this because there is an important and difficult question associated with it. The question is this. The natural tendency of all people, those who are altogether wrapped up in the secular life, as well as those who are concerned with the religious life, the natural tendency when any problem arises, any difficulty arises, is to look back into the past and say, oh, 10 years ago, there was a similar situation, and what did I do, and how did I tackle it, and so forth. And we try to draw from the past a method or the means by which we hope to solve the present situation. Nations do that. Relationships with other countries go wrong. They look back into history and they say, what are the lessons of history? Oh, a similar situation occurred in the 18th century or 16th century, and so and so did so and so. Now we'll apply our knowledge of history and deal with the situation in that way and hope for the best. And in our personal lives, we do that not only with regard to matters secular, but with matters religious. And when I say matters religious, I'm referring to things like this. If we are concerned with religion, we are concerned with realizing what we call the goal of the religious life. Freedom of the spirit, liberation, nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, use any phrase or word you like. We are concerned with achieving that goal. And all of us, therefore, those who are exclusively secular, those who are also, we all are secular to some extent, we have to be because we live in the world, those who are also religiously inclined. We all do that. We look back into the past. Such and such difficulties arose. My spirit was sore distressed, as you find the Old Testament prophets say, for instance. And we turn back to our own past experience. We turn the pages of the scriptures. We look at the lives of the great teachers and the saints and so forth, and hope to find, now this is the way to deal with it. And yet, great teachers have also taught, be fully and wholly attentive. This is the meaning of being awakened. Fully awakened, be wholly attentive to the immediate now. And do not look back into the past. So much so that in our own century, there has sprung one who unhesitatingly, totally rejects the whole of the past. So, this teaching causes perplexity. Reject the whole of the past? Can't we learn from the lessons of the past? Can't we look back to what the holy ones, the perfected ones, those who had realized fulfillment and so taught? Must we reject that and just be totally attentive to the immediate now? Let us try and understand what is implied in this. When I look back into the past, as I say, my past experience, the teachings of the great teachers of the past and so on, what am I looking at? Am I not looking at my memory of the past? But I deceive myself. I am looking at the past, the actual past. But the actual past, which in its own time and process was a living present, is now totally dead. It's a corpse as far as I am concerned. Supposing I was alive when it happened, 10 years, 50 years, I can go back 65 years and more in memory. When I am looking at that, I am not looking at that actual event, that living event. I am looking at a fossil, my memory of the past. Now, it's perfectly true that in the physical world, your scientist can investigate fossils and build up a tentative story of what happened in the process of the Earth's evolution and so forth. That is perfectly true. You get a picture of the shape of things, but nothing about the spirit of things. So when I look back into the past, I am looking at my memory. Now, what is my memory? Is it not just a thought shape? Verbalized, which I am recalling. I am recalling a set of words. I am trying to recall the sensations I may have had, the misery or delight which I experienced and so forth. But it's all vague and hazy, isn't it? I'm trying to recall all that which is past, when I myself was quite different from what I am now, and I'm under this airy-fairy illusion that it will help me to solve my present problem, which is obviously nonsensical. Consider another matter. When I went through that particular experience in the past, I myself was a conditioned, limited, confused, ignorant creature with a certain little knowledge of things. Part of that knowledge was all right. I could apply it and utilize it in the right way so that life went on harmoniously. But the greater part of it all was just a jumble. My memory, therefore, of that past and the impression on my own mind in that past was not true to the reality of the event. And I try to draw out from the dusty old pigeonholes of the hidden recesses of the mind these unreliable, inaccurate thought shapes and say, I will use them now because that situation was somewhat familiar, was somewhat similar to the present situation. But isn't that an absurdity altogether? Because if I could not produce a true resolution and a true harmony then, because if I did, a similar situation would never arise again. If I could not do it then, and I just have a vague memory of that past, I have the same sort of situation now, same sort of situation. What chance is there of my bringing about harmony now by harking back to the past? You had a car 50 years ago. Finally, it conked out, as we say. It broke down. The engine became totally useless and this and that and the other. The tires flat and so forth. You are in a little bit of a difficulty. Your new car is miles away being attended to or serviced. And you say, oh, I'll bring out this old car and use it. Now you have quite enough experience to know the likelihood is 99% suffering will follow you as the wheel of the cart follows the ox. Isn't that so? So there's no sense in dragging out old fossils, things which are dead, things which are of the past, which are by and large almost all unreliable and useless. You might say, but then, does that mean that all our past experience is totally valueless? We have learnt nothing? No, not totally valueless, not learnt nothing. But the part which is of real value and the part which you have actually learned is something which is not a thought shape, not a set of words. What is it? It is natural faculty which has been growing inside you. We'll come to that a little later. And it is living faculty which you can utilize in the immediate now. It has to be a faculty, a living thing. Power, skill, efficiency, everything is there in that living thing, not in that dead past, in the dead memory. Now, part of that experience has something to do with life itself. We are living creatures going through an experience, aren't we? And that livingness is something which we don't know. It is the hidden, the unknown to us. It is the creative, transformative energy in as we went through that experience. Something of that creative, transformative power came through, worked itself out in the right way. But the rightness was very small compared with the wrongness at that time. And if we merely hark back to the past, we are harking back to shapes which are concerned with the wrongness and not with the rightness. The rightness is invisible. Light itself is invisible. It is only because light is diffused through the air and because of dust particles and because objects, solid objects, reflect the light that we see. We never see light as such. If you look directly at a light, then only do the light rays enter your eyes, but you don't see light. You never see light as such. You experience lighted upness. It is the invisible. This creative part is the transcendent itself, the mystery. And it is that which releases faculty in you or me, the living being. Now, you remember a little while ago, we saw that consciousness itself is a great mystery. The innermost depths of consciousness, wherein this power manifests. We have the ability to direct attention to something or other. And if our faculty of attentiveness is utilized fully, totally, then that element in our nature which makes the isolative self-consciousness in us come between that to which we are attending in ourselves is out. And in that total attentiveness, self, the consciousness of self and not self has vanished. When the consciousness of self and not self has vanished, then this transmutative energy functions freely. And it releases faculty in the living organism, the living psychophysical organism. Then you really see, you understand as you've never understood before. In a small way, it applies to our geometrical theorem too. You follow every step and you understand the steps. Really understand it. That means that that which is represented in that logical intellectual process is part and parcel of your very being. You are it. And it is you. In terms of mind and consciousness. Obviously not in terms of body. So you have understood it. And you have faculty. You get it? So now, we begin to see why the great teachers have so insisted upon this. In various forms. You read the marvelous writings of the great Christian mystics, or the Sufi mystics, or any of the mystics of the world. Or read what the great intelligences, I won't call them intellectuals because that has a slightly that sort of feeling about it. But the great intelligences, religious intelligences, the spiritual geniuses who have realized and written about these things. And how, in one form or another, whether it be the theistic or whether it be the purely philosophical terminology which they used, you will find this insistence upon looking at, being completely concerned with transcendence itself. Call it God, call it transcendence, call it the infinite, call it the absolute, use what term you like. You see, because then all this surface stuff, the brown paper in which the present is wrapped is not obstructing you. You have removed that brown paper and you can enjoy the actual present. So now, when anything comes up in our ordinary everyday life, don't be concerned with the shapes of the past. Attend to it completely, so completely that there is no self-consciousness in the process of that attentiveness. And then you will find that this faculty which lies within you, yourself, and which has grown to some extent or other, becomes freely and totally operative. And the best possible result can come out of that, and that alone. Because now, all the memories of the past, which are inside us after all, they are imprinted not only on our brain cells, but throughout the entire organism. You see? All those will lose their power of limiting your observation, your understanding. And in the complete understanding is the complete resolution of the situation. You see? If you were to think in the usual mistaken terms of the people of the world, that, now I'll find out all my difficulties, all my vices, all my flaws, and I'll set to work and clean the whole lot out, root them out, lock, stock and barrel. Oh, very heroic, very marvelous, you know, and all the rest of it. But it's just flapdoodle. No one ever has done it. No one ever can do it. You know what Heracles did when he had to clean out the Augean stables? If he took a brush and pails of water or what, he would still be cleaning out the Augean stables. So much filth and rubbish. He turned the river. The river of life, which is the all, the totality, the invincible, did the washing. We have to learn how to turn this tap, this river of life. And that will do the washing. And the turning, you'll ask me now, well, how do I turn on the tap? I've told you already. Attend now completely to what is actually there. Use your eyes, your ears, your touch, and let the mind be quiet. Let the heart be quiet. And the best possible thing that can happen in this immediate living situation will happen and does happen. Only we don't see it. Why? Because we have our particular desires and longings interfering with it all. This is the trouble. You say, right, I paid full attention last September, and look, these other difficulties came. You did not pay full attention. You were desiring a particular result. Why? My will, O Lord, not thine. That's why. I'm a humbug, I'm a rogue. I'm trying to outwit the infinite. You see how subtly these things work? This is what I'm up against. Myself. So, this perfect attentiveness is something which completely excludes individual desire, conception, all our past knowledge, and everything. Living faculty is totally independent of all external shapes, especially those of the past. So, this perhaps is a way of understanding this question. How do we reject the past? We don't reject the past insofar as what we are now is inevitably the product of the past. That is true. What we do reject is our confused, distorted memories and all the rest of it. What we do reject is the intrusion of our foolish desires and pursuits and longings and all the rest of that. Now, you're in a state of purity. This is the meaning of the pure mind. And you see, this purity, this is sheer beauty. It is totally independent of any of the limited criteria of beauty and purity. In the complete absence of me, the one and only I am, which is the totality, functions through me without my knowing it. And it does what is requisite and what is best. By no means easy. And yet, remember this. Experiment. Try it. You won't come to harm. You really won't come to harm. Be totally and completely attentive so that you're free in that moment at least, or succession of a few moments. You're totally free of selfness. and a miracle of transformation of your whole being will take place. Because once you have done it, you can do it again and again. We have an analogy of that in the arts, for instance. An executant, a musician will say, or whoever it is, he struggles and struggles. At last, one fine day, when he has ceased to struggle, and he's just letting go, playing, he becomes unself-conscious, and lo and behold, suddenly the music is marvelous. It is the real thing, the real music. And at that magical moment, he's wide awake. He says, ah, this is how it is, of course. Having done it once, he can do it again and again, again and again. It is now your power. You can do it again and again. Take another analogy. Have you watched a little child in play, in real play, doing something athletic, for instance, high jump or a long jump or something like that? First he knocks the bar off every time. He gets fed up with it. Then he gets a feeling of, we'll just jump. We'll just jump. Not to achieve. And suddenly, everything in the body cooperates. He just jumps. Over the bar he goes. Ease comes. Ease. And ease is a word the Buddha used constantly in connection with the entry into the deep states of consciousness, leading right up to the very heart of nirvana itself. Ease is the word. Something which took me almost 20 years really to understand. Why that word? And then the bhikkhu feels a sense of perfect ease. Oh, well, all right, I've only got to put my feet up on the mantelpiece and I'm at ease. Oh, no, it's not that. It is something transcendent, this ease. And it is that ease which emerges into your life, out of your being and from outside into your being, as and when you attend wholly and completely free of the domination of the past.